Hello, welcome to another Little Atoms Road Trip podcast. I'm Neil Denny, I'm in Boston, and I spent the afternoon at Harvard Medical School in the lab of the geneticist George Church. George Church is a professor of genetics at Harvard Medical School and professor of health sciences and technology at Harvard and MIT, as well as a director of the US Department of Energy Center on Bioenergy at Harvard and MIT, and a director of the Center for Computational Genetics at Harvard Medical School. He co-developed the first direct genomic sequencing method in 1984, which helped to initiate the Human Genome Project. His revolutionary approach pioneered the use of automation to analyze millions of genetic sequences in one run, and his current research focuses on new technologies in personal genomics, leading to his 2005 initiation of the Personal Genome Project. George Church sits on the advisory board of more than 14 biotech companies, including personal genomics startup 23andMe and genetic testing pioneer DNA Direct. So I'm sat in Harvard Medical School in the office of George Church, and he's a professor of genetics here and the director of the Center for Computational Genetics. George, thanks for talking to Little Atoms today.
Oh, my pleasure.
I'd like to talk a little bit about how you got here, really. Let's talk a little bit about your background and how you became involved in genetics in the first place.
Well, I'd been interested in science most of my life, math and computers and medicine. My father was a physician from the time I was a teenager, early teen. And then, was trying to get in computers integrated with medicine was quite challenging. And the first real connection was actually X-ray crystallography, biophysics. And then it involved some automation, and it seemed like a cool thing to just automate the rest of biology.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've kind of been on that mission with a lot of other people recently. So that leads to, you can divide it up into reading biology, reading the universe, and writing, that is to say, synthesizing various aspects of it. And then there's various loops therein.
So this is where the computational genetics come in. I was going to ask you to explain what that actually means.
Yeah. Well, that covers all manner of things, including computational human genetics, reading the human genome and interpreting it, computational genetics on reading and writing human and bacterial genomes, and so on, and genomes of industrial significance, agricultural significance. Yeah.
So you've been involved in human genetics, particularly for right from the beginning of your career. Well, doing your PhD here at Harvard in 1984, you were instrumental in developing the first direct genomic sequencing method. Tell me about that.
Well, so in transitioning from crystallography, which was quite automated by the mm-hmm. time I left it, to DNA sequencing, which was completely non-automated at the time that I started in Wally Gilbert's lab, I was interested in rethinking the way we do sequencing. And so one of the things that struck me as valuable as a graduate student was the idea of turning it into a solid phase reprobing, where you would take essentially a sheet, a membrane, and immobilizing the whole genome onto that membrane and then accessing it, sort of random accessing the way you would a disk drive, by imaging that sheet and then applying chemicals to it to bring out a new image.
Mm-hmm.
And just doing that over and over to get different parts of the genome. So that was, and that in a led eventually to what we now call next generation sequencing. But back then it was almost contemporary with first generation sequencing.
You were there right at the beginning of the what became known as the Human Genome Project. Tell me how that project actually came about.
The Human Genome Project, I would say, originated in 1984, when we were tasked by the Department of Energy, we being a small group of about 10 scientists, were tasked to estimate mutation rates of human beings exposed to various hazards resulting from the energy industry.
Mm-hmm.
This could be chemicals, could be radiation, it could be other energy sources that were of unknown mutagenicity to humans.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in principle, you could measure mutation rates in animals or bacteria and then extrapolate humans, but they wanted to actually do it in humans. So this was in Alta, Utah in 1984, and we concluded within the first few minutes that this was well beyond our capabilities to speculate on, even, right? And so we said, well, what are we going to do the remaining 3 days? We could ski, since we were at Alta and there was nice snow. And we did. But it turned out this was the first time that people with these skills had been in the same room. And we had each been examining, kind of converging on the possibility of doing genomics. And in particular of sequencing genomes, or quite a few of us are mapping them. And so we proposed at the end, as a consolation prize or, you know, just something to take home, that we could sequence a genome. And we estimated just ballpark that it would be up to $3 billion, you know, about a dollar a base. It was a fairly optimistic number at the time because the largest genome that had been sequenced up to that point was only, it was almost a million times smaller than our goal, and it had probably been done at considerably more than a dollar a base. But we figured that there would be some improvements. But it was very vague, and I wanted it to be a technology development project because I felt that we could bring the price down considerably before we committed major amounts. But most people wanted it to be a production project where we would get it done and not worry about the cost. Just because we would be saving money just by doing it in an organized fashion. Mm-hmm. We would be saving, because already the National Institutes of Health was spending outrageous amounts of money on cloning and sequencing in a very higgledy-piggledy, one graduate student at a time, reinventing, relearning the draconian and difficult protocols.
And, of course, that's really how it proceeded. I mean, it ended up costing considerably more money than the original projection.
No, actually, it cost about what we projected, at $3 billion. But that's because there were some things that took longer and more expensive than we had projected, and the price came down a little bit. Not much, really. In fact, the price didn't really come down until the project was over, mm-hmm. or declared over. It's really not over. We haven't actually finished this genome, but it was declared over. And then suddenly the price changed. There were new technologies that were encouraged that had been kind of on hold while the project was in place. You know.
I raise that because you mentioned this idea that you wanted, your involvement began because you wanted to try and basically bring down the cost of that technology. All the way along, you've been involved in inventing the machines that did this sequencing, which is like an interesting position to be in the project. Right. Let's talk about that. Why do you think... It's an obvious question, perhaps, but what would be the benefits of making that sort of technology a lot cheaper?
Well, you know, making technology cheaper is not necessarily a respectable academic pursuit. Mm-hmm. You know, academics are supposed to be making gigantic discoveries like the genetic code or the double helix or something. And in comparison, making things cheaper sounds like something that it's barely even respectable for a company to do, mm-hmm. much less an academic. But anyway, for some reason I'm obsessed with that. For, you know, 35, 38 years now, among other things. I do other things. And the second concern about it, aside from respectability, is that if you brought the price down by a millionfold, which essentially we have over the last 8 years or so, maybe nobody wants that much sequence. You know, whereas if you brought down the price of cars or, you know, any clothes or anything like that, you're not going to go out and buy a million cars or a million mm-hmm. sport coats or something. You're going to buy pretty much the same number. You're just going to be cheaper. And that's not going to make it for the manufacturers. Mm-hmm. But as it turns out with sequencing, we've brought the price down a millionfold in the last 8 years, and people want 10 million times as much. And if we brought it down another hundredfold, they'd probably want a billion times as much relative to the beginning.
We'll come back to the cost of it, I guess, in terms of the cost being not much, a little later in the interview. But I want to talk as well about your involvement in the sequencing of the genome of Helicobacter pylori, which is the stomach bacteria, I guess most famous because Barry Marshall tested it on himself to prove that it gave gastric ulcers. And this is described as the first commercial genome sequence. So what's that, you know, what does that mean, the commercial? What's that distinction?
Well, so in 1994... we finished a sequence that the CEO of Genome Therapeutics announced that we would do in 5 months. And I think it took us 6 months to do it. And it was a bold thing for him to do it. You know, he didn't have a lot of support from the troops, meaning the people who were actually going to do it, because we were busy with government grants and various other projects. But he basically announced it, and we had to do it. I was mainly working on the technology, not so much on Helicobacter. I was working on the grant-related genomes. And, you know, 6 months was not bad. So it was the first commercial genome, mainly because all the genomes up to that point had been viruses, very small, tiny genomes, and not of commercial significance. And the human genome was still, you know, a decade in the future. So the next year, in 1995, the first non-commercial genome was published, full peer review and everything, which was Haemophilus influenzae. But during the months in between, we, meaning Genome Therapeutics, sold that Helicobacter genome twice, essentially to Schering Plough and to AstraZeneca. And they were non-exclusive, and then they went on to make other deals, you know, worth, I mean, those two alone, I think, were worth $75 million. And it established suddenly that there was actually a market for genomes. Even before the first academic genome had been finished, the commercial market was established. It was a remarkable inversion of the usual course of events.
And what sort of things could they use it for, I guess? What sort of things could AstraZeneca...
So the reason those two companies and many others to come were interested was they were running out of drug targets for antibiotics. And genomics was provided the potential for finding new drug targets, looking for genes that might be conserved among all or among a class of organisms, you know, might be present in bacteria and not in humans, and that would be a good target. If it's highly conserved, that means you could get a broad-spectrum antibiotic. Or if it's not conserved, you could get a narrow spectrum. That was the basic idea. And most of the companies knew they would need awesome new technology and bioinformatics, and they had nothing. They had squat in terms of either of those. And they were kind of nervous, I would say, maybe even fearful that one of their competitors would get to sequencing and bioinformatics before they did. And so they felt it was a fairly, it was chump change for them to get in the game. And both of them were specifically interested in stomach ulcers and the stomach cancer, which were the consequences of Helicobacter. And they were interested in other microorganisms as well. So that it was a no-brainer for them. And in fact, our CEO knew that. And that's the reason he announced it in advance and gave them time to basically watch us in public either succeed or fail.
And there's obviously developed since, you know, stupendously big market for this sort of thing. I mean, you yourself have started a long list of genomics companies, but in some respects, I think one of the most exciting things you do is you're very much into the idea of open source. It's something that we're interested very much on this radio program. So I want to bring us on to your personal genome project, which I guess came out of the Human Genome Project. But tell us why you started this.
So the human genome was valuable in that it kind of gave us a feeling for what we needed to do, but we all knew that what we needed to do next was to correlate the diversity of human genomes, not just one, which was the reason I was very upset with the $3 billion price tag, because you couldn't do that many, many times. We needed to correlate the diversity of genomes with the diversity of traits, medical and otherwise. And to do that, you needed to collect them together. And they needed to be shared because there's so many different ways of looking at it. I mean, these conceivably are the most complicated structures we've ever studied, humans have ever studied. I mean, far more complicated than any man-made object. And it's a whole population of these complicated objects. And so it seemed like a really obvious case for open source to me. On the other hand, it's one of the hardest to do open source because you not only have the usual forces that keep things closed, which are proprietary forces, academic achievement-based forces where you want to hoard things, whether you think they're profitable or not, you just want to hoard them for your career. But in addition, you had privacy issues, which would allow you to hide behind them. Very often, it wasn't really about privacy. It was about proprietary and career motivations. But you could conflate these and really prevent sharing. So we wanted to disentangle this and make it so that there was really a way that we could share this incredibly valuable data set and really, you know, not do the usual practice, which is to go out and get a big grant, get a big cohort, and then feel like, well, I worked so hard getting this grant and getting this cohort, I need to milk it for all it's worth, I need to possess it. We didn't want to possess the cohort. We wanted to actually collaborate with the cohort and have them equally available to anybody. And so we developed a new protocol for consenting that specifically looked for people who knew what they were getting into and were willing to share. And it really cut through the Gordian knot of worrying about whether you might accidentally release data on these individuals or someone, you know, might, for whatever reason, do it on purpose.
And in some respects, that was like, well, I guess that was almost forced upon you because that was sort of insisted on, wasn't it, by the people who funded it that said, you know, you had to have the first group of people were going to be people that were geneticists, basically, people that had some sort of background.
that wasn't the people funded. The funding for it was really funding for technology development.
Mm-hmm.
And I had, even though the original grant was starting with sequencing bacteria, I had a feeling that it would go quickly enough that we might be sequencing humans by the end. And indeed, we had achieved our five-year goals in about 8 months. The granting agency wasn't so concerned about the ethical components of doing human research. We were, and so it was the IRB that required, so the Institutional Review Board at Harvard that looks over anything involving human subjects research, that said, okay, we're going to start slowly. They made lots of suggestions immediately, and over the years, we've been doing this now for about 7 years, they made lots of suggestions, including starting slowly with a very small cohort of 1 to 10 individuals, and they wanted them to be highly engaged so that they knew what they were getting into. They wanted them to be master's degrees in genetics or equivalent. Now, as it turns out, of the original 10, only one had a master's, actually had a PhD, which was Misha Ingris, and all the rest of us had the or equivalent. This range from, you know, I had a, you know, degree in biochemistry and in chemistry, but Esther Dyson had a bachelor's degree in economics, but she was an investor in genetics and in personalized medicine, and so she got it, and they accepted it, and they looked through the CVs. But we realized that looking at CVs wasn't, looking at the resumes of the participants was not going to be scalable to 100,000, which is what we wanted to do next.
So this is where the consent form comes in.
Right. So, well, you have to have a consent form no matter
what. Your new consent form.
There were two new ideas in here. One of them was consenting people for openness. In other words, rather than finding people who were hesitant about openness, we found people who were okay with it. And that meant we didn't have to make all kinds of guarantees, which meant all kinds of baggage, complicated baggage that comes from de-identifying and vetting who has access to the data and making sure that it doesn't slip out and all that. That was greatly made simpler. But in addition, it made it put the participants at lower risk because if you are the sort of person who has reason to believe you would be at risk, then you're discouraged from entering the project. Mm-hmm. And so really, it's if you get into a regular project and they promise you security, and then something bad happens accidentally or on purpose, then you're upset and your family is upset and there's stress involved just from the disclosure, you know, just from the fact that your trust has been betrayed. Well, if the contract up front is different, then it's okay. So that was one thing that was different about the consent. When we transitioned from 10 people to 100,000, we added or we replaced looking over resumes with an entrance exam. And this, there was all kinds of serendipitous discoveries in addition to all the wonderful suggestions that the Institutional Review Board made that we adopted. This one, we found that people, even though it was a very hard test to start out with, and we made it easier and easier over time, we didn't want to start out easy and make it hard. We wanted to start out hard and make it easy. A lot of people took great pride in passing the test. It's kind of like the harder we made it to get in, the more people wanted to get into the project. You know, it's like a country club or something, right? And the result was we have an incredibly enthusiastic cohort. I mean, these are people that keep coming back for more, keep asking, how fast are you going to give us another test? Not a questionnaire, but an actual, you know, or question. It could be questionnaires, could be a blood test, or a, you know, whatever the next new thing is. And it's really a, it's a fantastically fun cohort to work with.
What sort of things did the test contain then? Because you're not, clearly then you're not saying just, you know, multiple times, are you sure you want to, you know, no, are you sure you want to do this? And that sort of psychological thing. It's a test.
Right. So we didn't really care if they had mastered genetics. I mean, we didn't really care if they knew the nuances of non-disjunction or something, of chromosomes. What we cared was that they understood to what extent their information affected their family. Because unlike certain kinds of medical research where, you know, like if I inject you with a new drug, that doesn't really impact your family as long as it doesn't kill you. It doesn't expose them to the risks other than loss of your functionality. In this case, there was a slight, we didn't want to over or understate how impactful it was on knowledge of other people in the family.
Yeah.
So there are very few traits where knowing one person in the family tells you anything fundamental about everybody else in the family. It tells you sort of probabilistic. It's already probabilistic about you, and it's even more one step removed. You know, might have a 50% chance or 25% chance that somebody else in the family would be, your closest relatives would be affected. But we wanted to make sure they got that part and that they communicated to their family and they got the family buy-in. Now, our Institutional Review Board did not, as most would not, did not require that we get family consent, because the general ethical principle is that the individual is the paramount importance, as long as you get the individual's permission. But we felt that we would go a little bit beyond the minimum requirements and ask them to check with their immediate family members. And there have been a few that we have had to reject because at least one family member was not enthusiastic.
The key idea behind this all along was that the genomes would be published on the internet. They would basically be, you know, entirely open source. That's the point. So what was the driving force behind that? Why do that rather than just be building a big sort of medical database of 100,000 people's genomes?
Well, by medical database, you mean one that which could be selectively shared?
Yeah, one that's here at Harvard Medical School that can be used by researchers, but not necessarily sort of accessed by people on the internet.
So one of the problems is, who judges who's a researcher?
Mm-hmm.
What is the definition of a researcher? Like, you know, if there's some 11-year-old genius in Indiana or a very poor programmer in Mumbai, India, am I going to say they're not a researcher?
Mm-hmm.
You know, who's going to make that decision? They could cure a disease 20 years earlier just because they have the right mindset. They have a different way of looking at things. If we just let the people who are the experts at it, there's a chance that they will get out what we put in. Is that they will come with a bunch of preconceived notions,
mm-hmm.
and they'll either confirm their notions, which are wrong, or they will find nothing,
mm-hmm.
because they can't wrap their mind around the changes. Because this is radically new kinds of data, and we really don't know the answers in advance. So that was one big thing, was just deciding who would have access or not. The other thing is that if you restrict it at all, then you get into really bizarre clashes where someone will want to send it to someone else, and then you have to make sure that other person is vetted, and that takes time.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to make sure that second person, after they're vetted, knows the rules, that they're properly educated, and they don't, like, leave their disk drive on a subway, and it happens all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, I felt it was disingenuous to be creating a setting where the researchers and the participants felt that everything was safe, because we had put in all, you know, the more safeguards we put in place, the more serious it seems, the more likely it seems that there's no risk. And even though you might put in a clause somewhere in the fine print, there is a risk of disclosure. The fact is, the more barriers you put, the less. But the fact is, it happens all the time. You know, 26 million veterans, you know, the United States military got their medical records exposed. Massachusetts General Hospital. Almost every major type of research, or even non-research medical, has had an incident. And some of them have been quite distressing. And so I felt, do we need to do that?
Yeah, so there is always, as you mentioned, there's lots of examples of loss of data, but that loss of data is only a loss because the data was secret in the first place. So,
right.
But there are still, you're quite militant, shall we say, on the open source thing. You've published data about yourself on your website that other people would probably be a bit more reluctant to do. So do you think the dangers that remain about putting that sort of private information on the internet, beyond what we've just discussed, are removed? Do you think they're overstated? I mean, do you think there are still issues with it?
Well, I'm not militant in the sense that I insist that other people
But with your own personal
or
data,
other researchers or anything like that. But yes, my IRB at Harvard did request that I be one, that I take my own medicine, that I be the first in line for, not just for the disclosure, but for all the medical procedures, you know, getting a punch biopsy of my skin. I was the first one for that.
But I guess you would have done that anyway.
Not necessarily. Probably I was inclined, at least for the disclosure part, but I think I became a little bit more encouraged by the IRB. You know, I'm not far from alone. It was one of the big experiments, was how many people would do that. There apparently are many thousands of people. We have over 1,800 that already have their medical records online on ours. And I have every reason to believe we get millions of people to do this. We don't need to get 7 billion people, although that would be nice. Maybe if the first million have a good time and or get some benefit out of it or see some benefit to society, more importantly, then there will be additional. So we are highly motivated to make sure that this goes well, that there aren't too many disasters. Now, there will be some. I mean, you know, we're not perfect, and the world isn't perfect, and some things can. But as long as the benefits greatly exceed the downsides, I think it will spread and people will enjoy it. And it's a great way to get educated about, you know, this new revolution. This could be bigger than the internet and personal computing. I mean, this is about you as well. So it's much less abstract than astronomy or even personal computers, right?
I guess it's early days, yeah. You've been doing this for about 7 years, and you were talking before about, you know, somebody in India finding a cure to a disease 20 years down the line or something. Yeah. What things have gone on already?
Well, so, you know, the first few years were really just dealing with making sure we had ethical components right, working with the IRB to get the protocols lined up right, integrating the technology, a lot of infrastructure building. Now it's starting to heat up. It's one of these things where any day now it could go exponential, go viral, go whatever, the way that the World Wide Web did in 1993. There were zero websites at the beginning of the year, and about 12 months later there were millions of websites, including the first commercial websites and so forth. I think that could happen with a personal genome project at any moment. You can see that kind of enthusiasm growing.
How can people who are listening to this sign up?
Well, they need to decide whether it's for them. They could go to personalgenomes.org. So it's a nonprofit with a website, personalgenomes.org. And there's a lot of information. You can see what other people have done, you know, what the 1,800 starting members have done, and go through the test and find out whether it's, what, you know, in the process of taking the test, you learn whether you're actually interested or not.
Okay, I want to move us on to synthetic biology.
Okay.
And one of the other things I think I guess you're most well known for is that you've invented a process for producing diesel from bacteria. Tell us about this. Where does this idea come from?
Well, just like the personal genomics, this is a team effort. I mean, I can't take that much personal credit for it, but one of the ideas behind synthetic biology is to have applications. Some of the obvious first round of applications would be for either discovering drugs or manufacturing them, drugs and chemicals and so forth, at low cost. There's that low cost again. Or in a safer manner, something that's better for the environment, something that's greener. So there was a long list of chemicals that the Department of Energy developed that were relatively high value, but varying market size. I mean, they were all big-ish markets. But the biggest market of all, of course, was fuels. And it turns out that if you look chemically at the fuel molecule, it looks a lot like one of the major components of cells, which is their membrane components, the lipids, the fatty acids, and the lipids. You need to change it from that. If you just threw fatty acids in, or lipids or fats into a typical car, it would be a bad thing. But if you remove the acid part from the fatty acid, what you're left with is an alkane, which is basically a hydrocarbon, which is just carbons and hydrogens, about two hydrogens per carbon. And this is what constitutes gasoline and diesel. And so all we had to do, I mean, it's a big if, was to find the enzymes that would remove that acid group and then tweak the whole system so it would produce lots of fatty acids with their acids groups removed and then pump that fuel out into the media. So that was a nice, clean idea. Simultaneous with this, though, well, there were a lot of people that wanted instant gratification. They wanted biofuels right away so they could, you know, there's always somebody that wants to be the first without really having the right product. And so they would, for example, do corn to ethanol. It's now a famous disaster, which almost everybody in the field that I knew, that knew what was going on, knew that was a bad idea. But it happened anyway, because there were people who could cash in on it. And they could either claim they were the first or make a little money and get out, whatever. It was a very cynical way of doing it. We didn't do that. We didn't go for corn to ethanol. Instead, we went for microbial systems that would make alkane and diesel. There's a little confusion about biodiesel in that people think of, oh, I'm going to get fat from French fries and I'm going to re-esterify it, meaning we're not actually going to get rid of the acid group, we're going to cover it with a methyl or ethyl group. And those do work in engines, but it's not that general and it's not the best fuel. It's not immediately a great plug-in fuel. And you still have to solve the problem of getting an organism, a plant or a microorganism that will crank it out. So we felt, since you're going to be making us fuel from scratch anyway, why change the cars to accommodate your fuel? Just make the bug make the right fuel.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we did at LS9 and then similar effort at Juul Unlimited. LS9 is a California company and Juul is a Massachusetts company. And I founded both of them with different goals in mind.
I was there a couple of weeks ago at the Los Alamos National Labs, and I talked to Barbara Maroney and a couple of people from her team about the idea of making fuel from green algae. So how does this differ to that?
Well, so a not-so-subtle distinction between what people call algae
mm-hmm.
and bacteria. Cyanobacteria is the closest bacteria. They are photosynthetic, just like algae. And algae is photosynthetic, just mm-hmm. like corn. But the big difference is that cyanobacteria are much more efficient than algae or corn. And furthermore, algae, is the way it's normally done, doesn't have to be done this way, but it's often done in ponds where there's very poor gas exchange going from the atmosphere into the pond. While if you can make, and we have made, inexpensive bioreactors, just cheap, thin plastic, but engineered in such a way that you're stirring the cells with the gases, so you're getting good gas exchange and a bunch of other benefits. Now suddenly it's a completely new ballgame because mm-hmm. Both the organism is better. We heavily genetically engineer them. So these are not like off-the-shelf things that happen to make lipids.
Mm-hmm.
These are really engineered to make real fuels that are completely plug-in compatible. And then finally, we have this inexpensive but sophisticated bioreactors.
I saw photographs on your website of the tanks, and basically it's as simple as you leave this thing out in the sunlight. And how does the process actually actually work?
Well, so you have to provide it with at least four things. It's sunlight, mm-hmm. carbon dioxide, which is most people want to get rid of it, so that's easy. You have to remove the waste. The waste in this case is oxygen, which isn't such a bad waste to have. It's not like a hazardous waste mm-hmm. to most people. And then you have to remove the fuel. Bioreactor keeps the gases stirred up to both bring the carbon dioxide in and remove the oxygen. And you need to provide water, too, because it's water that's providing the hydrogens and the hydrocarbon, which ultimately is the source of energy. Now, you don't have to, if you have an open pond, especially in a desert,
mm-hmm.
you've got evaporation going mm-hmm. on. You don't have that kind of water use. You have basically, you're turning water into fuel. It's a pretty good deal. And you don't have to use valuable agricultural water, irrigation water, or drinking water. You're using brackish water. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's water that's just disgusting, salty, and, these guys will grow in it. These cyanobacteria will grow in brackish water, and they will grow on land, which you couldn't grow anything on. It can even grow on deserts, so we have deserts that are growing. The deserts themselves are expanding. We can now reclaim some of that land around the edges of the desert and produce fuel or, in principle, other chemicals or even foods with these engineered cyanobacteria.
I just want to reiterate something you said there, because it's clearly one of the most important aspects of this. You're able to take CO2 out of the atmosphere.
So we can either partner with companies that are producing CO2 as mm-hmm. a waste to make it a net neutral, or with time we can actually start removing CO2 directly from the atmosphere.
Where are you with this now? At what point will we see this, or do you envision it scaling up to a point where it can be actually affordable and usable by the public?
So both LS9 and Juul are at the production phase now. So they've got pilot plants that are scaling up into the many tens of thousands of tons of product. These are not an academic dream. The economics that I've seen, and I don't do this on a daily basis, but other people in the company, seem like it's within the range of the petrochemicals. There definitely are biopetrochemicals that we can make that are competitive economically. They don't require subsidies. They don't require companies that want to look green, although they benefit from those. Mm-hmm. They're really quite competitive now, and they will get better. There's definitely room for improvement in all of the processes and the genetics and in the bioreactors and so forth. So, I think it's tough working in the commodity field, but the bonus is that you've got a gigantic market.
To finish off then, there's an idea of synthetic biology as technology, and I guess that must be the thing that appeals to you about it?
Well, I like biological research. You know, most of what I do is academic. You know, we spin off companies as we discover things. But it's nice to have both a philosophically novel approach, something that's technically novel, and something that has an application for society. If you can get all three of those at once, mm-hmm. I mean, why would you do a project that only does one of those, right? And so even in my most academic pursuits, I try to, it helps focus one's energy if you have a distant goal, which sometimes comes closer faster than you ever imagined, like this, how quickly the cost of sequencing, mm-hmm. we were able to bring that down. And to some extent, I've been pleased to how quickly these fuels have gone from an idea to gigantic plants manufacturing them.
What sort of things can you speculate a little bit? What sort of where will synthetic biology go in the next 20 years? What sort of things do you envision seeing?
Well, so synthetic biology, immediate payoffs are clearly lower cost chemicals and pharmaceuticals. Discovery of new pharmaceuticals like company Warp Drive we just started. But next, after that, is at least two radical dimensions. One of them is genetically engineering human cells. Not human beings, but human cells. So we already have phase two clinical trials for taking cells out of my body, getting rid of both normally working copies of the gene CCR5, which is the HIV-AIDS virus receptor, and then putting them back into my body. And even if I already had full-blown AIDS, I now become AIDS-resistant. It's not just I'm a little... You really cure the disease by engineering your own cells. So engineering human cells, big deal. The other thing is engineering materials, not just chemicals, but engineering very complicated materials. So it's kind of like the extension of Moore's Law or the extension of our ability to microfabricate things down to nanofabricating things. And it has the advantage over all previous engineering disciplines. You know, we should be able to make anything. We should be able to make anything electronics can make or mechanical engineering or plastics, or we should be able to make. And they could be essentially infinitely complex. They can be atomically precise, and they can be dirt cheap, because wood is essentially a very complex material that's almost atomically precise. It couldn't be made atomically, and it's one of the cheapest materials on the planet. Mm-hmm. We can make everything that way, and they grow exponentially. You know, you can get bacterial cells that replicate at sort of, 15 minutes doubling time. Imagine you could double your car in 15 minutes, or your home, or your, clothing, your computer. You know, if they grew themselves from sunlight and carbon dioxide, wouldn't that be great? So that's the most radical that we can should not dismiss easily.
Another side of synthetic biology that sort of feeds into the idea of personal genomics that we were talking about earlier is this idea that people can you can go on the internet and buy a little sequence of DNA for tinkering with at home, and we've got the personal genome project on the web. So how is this going to feed into open source? How many of these great advances in the next 50 years are going to be done by people tinkering in their garage rather than like in the Harvard Medical School?
Well, it's a very interesting possibility. I've been involved in the do-it-yourself biology or DIY bio movement, which has both analytic and synthetic components, both reading and writing. And it sounds a little, it feels, tastes a little like the garage hackers of...
Yeah, the home computer club. Homebrew computer club, exactly.
With electronics and software and all that. And it probably will be. Mm-hmm. It's, in a way, it's kind of even cooler in that it's, again, it's about your body. You can engineer your body. Now, you have to be careful about that, right? But what happens is everything has risks, and they eventually, actually very quickly, get mitigated. People will stay away from the risky things, and they'll move to the things that are safer. It might start with people engineering their microbiome. A lot of people have gastrointestinal problems, mm-hmm. Not just ulcers, but gaseous problems and pain and so forth. They could engineer that. That might be one of the first things that happen. But it's not clear where it goes. It'll start out also analytic, just reading what it is I'm at risk at. As I walk down the street, we're getting now close to handheld sequencing devices. It could be part of your cell phone as you walk down the street. You might not even call it do-it-yourself biology. My cell phone is monitoring whether I'm running into H1N1 or bird flu or some other nasty thing that I don't want. Or I can test the water or test my food before I eat it, really quickly. Just see, is this got salmonella in it? And I think that is people will recognize as very practical. The homebrew computing, you had to be semi-visionary, do-it-yourselfer, to imagine what you were going to do with a computer. But it's quite evident what you're going to do in testing your food, your air, your water, you know, your kids before you send them to daycare. All these things are going to be very intuitively obvious to people.
That's a really exciting point for us to end on. So I've been talking to George Church. George, thank you very much for talking to me today.
Oh, my great pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Misha Angrist. That was a Little Adams Road Trip podcast. The show was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was made possible by a traveling fellowship from the Winston Churchill Memorial Trust. Follow the trip on Twitter @LittleAdams, and thanks for listening.